Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts, arts and entertainment, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we'll hear once again from Miles Johnson with a radio essay exploring one of the more successful producers in the world of rap and hip-hop. We're going to start, though, with Emmanuel Rogers checking out a book which is rooted in something which started here in San Bernardino, McDonald's.
Joining us now is Lisa Napoli. Lisa is a freelance writer, has a really informative podcast on aging, and the author of Ray and Joan, The Man Who Made the McDonald's Fortune and The Woman Who Gave It All Away. Thank you for joining us today, Lisa.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you are more than welcome. I have been looking forward to this because Joan is paramount in your book, so you raised a lot of interest for me there.
Good.
Your book, Ray and Joan, tells the story of the founder of the McDonald's franchise we know today. But now, Ray Kroc and the woman who stood by him, Joan Smith, who later became Joan Kroc, what inspired you to write about them?
You know, people think that it's because I had some sort of connection to McDonald's or connection to the Kroc family, and it was neither. It was just really curiosity. I was covering art for the public radio station KCRW over in Santa Monica, and I went to cover a peace sculpture, a giant nuclear mushroom cloud sculpture that was in disrepair. And I found out that it was built initially because of an anonymous gift by Joan Kroc. And I thought it was weird because she didn't live anywhere near there. And I didn't know that she was a peace activist. And the more I thought about it, I didn't really know anything about her except that she'd given this huge gift to public radio when she died in 2003. And so I looked for a biography about her. I love biographies. I love reading biographies about strong women or just interesting people in general. And there wasn't one, but I did read an obituary that really piqued my interest. And I thought, you know, people, we know about Bill Gates and his philanthropy. People know about Warren Buffett and his philanthropy. But her philanthropy was so wide-ranging and unusual, it just made me want to know more. So I thought, heck, I'll write a biography, not realizing that it would take over the next 5 years of my life.
Now, Lisa, before we get too far ahead with Ray and Joan, I understand that you are a freelance writer. What does that entail for you?
Well, I'm a veteran of many, many news organizations, including the New York Times, MSNBC, Public Radio's Marketplace, and I'm at a stage in my life where I don't have an affiliation, so I just write for hire. When anybody hires me, which unfortunately isn't enough these days, I write journalism or sometimes marketing copy or speeches. But I made the transition into writing books about 10 years ago because of an experience I had in a little country in Asia, and I just couldn't get it out of my brain, and I wound up writing a book and being fortunate enough to sell a book. Okay. And that sort of led me on this freelance path that I've been on and off for the course of my 35 years of working. And I've worked in radio and television and print and web and all kinds of things, which is exciting, but is not a very stable career financially, for sure.
Okay. But you must have come in contact with a lot of interesting people and learned a lot over these years.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all have that ability. If our eyes are open and you're paying attention, there's something that everybody has to say that's interesting. And I've never been interested in people who are famous as much as I am and just regular people who are doing interesting things. I find that much more captivating. So it's funny because living here in Los Angeles, a lot of people I know assume that, you know, you're dancing around Hollywood, and that's cool if that's what you do and what you love. But for me, the guy sitting next to me on the bus or, you know, in the grocery store is more likely to have some interesting stories. And that's why I'm captivated by aging, too. As I'm getting older, I love looking at older people and saying, you know, that person looks like they're just an old sick person now, maybe. Right. But they had a whole life that nobody asked them about. Ask them and you'll find out something interesting.
Yeah, that is great. Just loving to talk to people. I understand.
I can imagine doing what you do for a living. Absolutely. I would hope so. Curiosity fuels people like us, but I think it fuels a lot of people, and a lot of people who are in the media, I think, are surprised when they run across someone who doesn't need to be professionally curious, but just naturally are open and interested in the world around them. What's the point of living if you're not?
Yeah, you know, I found for myself it's a matter of being interested in what other people are or doing or whatever's going on in their life without being nosy, but just liking people.
You raise a really interesting point, because I think when I worked in the Kingdom of Bhutan, this tiny little Asian country that when I went there didn't have media, hadn't had media for a very long time, and my job was to work with young people at a youth-oriented radio station.
Okay.
And the culture there was that if you asked questions of people, particularly of people older than you or in a higher rank than you, then that was extremely disrespectful. So here, if you gave a bunch of high school, college students a recorder and said, go out and tell stories about the world around you and interview your elders or interview just the people you know in your daily life, a lot of them would go and do really interesting things. But there, we had to teach people that it was acceptable to do that because it hadn't been culturally acceptable for them. And it is a fine line between being invasive. And I think it goes back to how you ask the question, right?
Right.
You know, and that was something that presented itself for me many times in writing this book about Ray and Joan Crook, because both of them were deceased. I couldn't ask them.
Right.
So I would call up people and say, hey, I'm interested. I've read about this particular thread of your lives together, and I'd love to know more. And you know, sometimes I'd be immediately defensive, thinking that I was trying to do some sort of hatchet job. And I would explain, no, I'm just curious. I just want to know more. And there's a lot to learn from it. That is a challenge, for sure.
Yes, it is. Let's see. You're also doing some research right now for writing a book on CNN. Can you share with us a little bit about that?
I was really fortunate when I started my career, even before I got out of college, to wind up interning at a place that was very little known at that time because it had just launched, CNN. It was 1981,
wow.
And CNN launched in 1980. So when I went to volunteer there as an intern and then work there in 1984, it wasn't the powerful, polarizing force that it is today.
Right.
And so when my last book about Ray and Joan came out, an old friend of mine from my CNN days called me up and he said, look, you just wrote this book about the making of this iconic brand. I have your next book for you. It's got to be about CNN and the creation of CNN. And I thought, you know what? There have been books written, of course, about Ted Turner and all kinds of things written about CNN. But very few people know the story about what gave rise to CNN, just the way very few people, you know, everybody knows what McDonald's is, love it or hate it.
Right.
But very few people understand how it happened. And so that's what I've been researching, is how in the 1970s, Ted Turner took this crazy little low-power television station that he bought on a lark and turned an empire into what it became.
Wow. I look forward to it.
I hope so.
Well, we're just waiting on you.
Yes. Gotta go.
Okay. Now, as we delve into the book, Ray and Joan, I would like to ask you, who were the McDonald brothers?
That's a good and important question. The McDonald brothers were two men who came west in the early part of the last century, and they were in search of a vision for themselves, of working for themselves. They wanted to be entrepreneurial, and they worked in the early days of the Hollywood industry, hauling sets. They found it very quickly. It wasn't glamorous. They couldn't make their way to become producers. So they wound up buying a movie theater in Glendora. Now, they didn't work in the movies. They showed the movies. And that didn't work out. The Depression and the concession stands were really making more money than the movie themselves, the movies showing the movies. And they, over a period of time, opened up this, what became, as some people who might be lucky enough to have been around that long, McDonald's. It took some trial and error and experimentation before they arrived at the burger formula, but they were just guys trying to make a living and trying not to work for somebody else because they knew that that was not the security that they wanted in their lives.
Okay. How did they come about to meet Ray Kroc? What happened there?
Ray Kroc was a milkshake machine salesman in Chicago.
Right.
And people knew about the brothers in part because they took ads out in trade magazines, but also because the industry knew about this phenomenon that was happening in San Bernardino with the McDonald's hamburger stand.
Okay.
And Ray was selling these milkshake machines. They bought a bunch of them for some various franchises that they had started. And he was curious. He was out west for a restaurant show, and he rented a car and drove to San Bernardino from Los Angeles and wanted to see what it looked like. And a lot of people at the time that Ray did that were doing that too. A lot of other entrepreneurs who wanted to take the idea, the formula that the brothers had developed of speedy service back to wherever they lived, were showing up in the parking lot and marveling at how quickly they could turn out this food. And Ray was among them, and he convinced the brothers to let him be their new franchise agent. Their franchise agent had fallen ill, and they were not thrilled with the idea of growing too fast. But Ray had this vision of going national, and that's how they connected.
That's Lisa Napoli in conversation with Emmanuel Rogers. We are hearing about her book, Ray and Joan, The Man Who Made the McDonald's Fortune and the Woman Who Gave It All Away. You may have seen the movie The Founder, starring Michael Keaton. That just covers a portion of the story, and we'll hear about some of the inaccuracies later in the program. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Find many KVC Arts shows via podcast through iTunes, NPR One, Spotify, and Google Play. And most past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. Later in the program, we'll hear a brief radio essay from Miles Johnson looking at one of the more successful producers in the world of rap and hip-hop. First, though, back to McDonald's with Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Lisa Napoli about her book, Ray and Joan, The Man Who Made the McDonald's Fortune and the Woman Who Gave It All Away. Just ahead, some of the friction between Ray Kroc and the McDonald brothers.
Now, as the relationship went on, there came to be some problems between the two. What happened?
Number of things happened. Ray was in the middle of the country. He was geographically distant from the brothers, who were still working very hard to run their restaurant every single day.
Right.
Ray, from the very beginning, was acting not like an employee, which he basically was. He was a franchise agent working for the brothers. He didn't behave that way, though. He behaved as if McDonald's Corporation was his own. And so there was some natural friction between the brothers and Ray and his team of people who he grew to manage the McDonald's that they were selling to franchisees initially in the middle part of the country and then eventually all over. And, you know, they had different visions, but also, as often happens with business partnerships, you know, it's very hard to have a shared vision that marches forward. That's why there's so many divorces, right?
I mean, right.
In business and in relationships, it's hard to keep on the same path. And Ray realized after a period of time with his chief money man, Harry Sonnenborn, that they couldn't keep borrowing the money that they needed to borrow in order to develop McDonald's if they kept up this relationship with the brothers. And the brothers really were sort of getting tired of Ray. Ray was a difficult guy. They were making plenty of money. And so when Ray came to them and said, look, we want to buy you out, they said, sure, if you pay us $2.7 million, we'll go away. And Ray freaked out because he didn't have $2.7 million.
Yeah.
And he didn't know how he was going to borrow it.
Right.
I know I might be getting ahead of myself here, but yeah, so the brother said, okay, if you can't come up with the $2.7 million, we'll keep collecting the royalty that you're paying us. He was paying them 0.5% of what every single McDonald's that was coming online across the country was earning.
Okay.
So they were making tremendous money. Ray was making next to nothing because he was growing so fast and couldn't keep up with it. So he was resentful of the brothers who had not only their successful restaurant, but this passive income coming in, 0.5%,
right,
which was part of their deal. And so when Ray said, I'll buy you out, and the brothers said, name their figure, Ray couldn't come up with a figure. And the brothers said, well, we'll just keep with the way things are. We've got a good contract. We're making some good money. We'll just keep going. There's no incentive for us to let you pay us over time. If you can't give us the sum, we'll just keep going. And Ray's money man, Harry Sonnenborn, went out and managed to artfully convince a group of investors to give him the $2.7 million that was necessary.
Wow.
And the brothers got their check, and they went on their merry way.
Wow. Now, I understand there was also some tension because they felt Ray was just pushy or bossy.
You know, they did, but they were, I think, broadsided by how Ray took idea and ran with it.
Oh.
And they had never wanted to be in the business of managing a group of restaurants. They had turned down Carnation brand milk when it had come to them before to franchise because they didn't want to be in the tedious business. I mean, they were in the tedious enough business of managing and keeping their restaurant successful. And Ray was pushy. A lot of people had a hard time with Ray. A lot of people got really rich because of Ray.
Wow.
So he was a polarizing figure. And the brothers also had made enough. People find this story so hard to believe because they don't understand why the brothers wouldn't want to go public. The truth is that when Ray came to buy them out in 1961, the McDonald's Corporation was not doing so well.
Okay.
There was no indication that it was going to become what it ultimately became. And the analogy I use is if I have a house and I sell it to you, and then 10 years later the neighborhood is gentrified and it's now worth 10 times what you paid for it, you weren't screwing me out of money. You basically bought my house fair and square at a time when it was worth less, and now it's worth more. Maybe you put a lot of money into fixing it up.
Right.
And that's basically what happened with the McDonald's brothers. You know, Ray said, we want to buy you out. The brothers stated their terms. Ray and his team figured out how to meet those terms, and the brothers ran off into the sunset, and Ray ran off into the sunset with the company and the name of the company. And everybody for a long while was okay with that, because it was a business deal.
You know, and that's one of the strange things for me here. I can understand not using Ray's last name for the business, but why did he keep McDonald's?
He always said that he loved the name McDonald's from the minute he saw it.
Ah.
He had a sense, I think almost the exact line he used in his memoir was that McDonald's evoked this image of a fairy tale, of a nursery rhyme. And it just sounded all American and clean and friendly. And, you know, Croc, not a clean, friendly name.
Right.
But he always said, who would want to eat a Croc?
I would.
But the truth is, yeah. Okay, well, we have to market to you. You're a good one. But no, the funny thing, Emmanuel, is that when the brothers, Dick and Max, sold their very first franchise, was to a guy named Neil Fox. And Neil Fox was very proud of building the first franchised McDonald's. And the brothers said to him, we don't understand why you're calling your restaurant. We get that you bought our blueprints and you like the way we prepare hamburgers and move food quickly through this assembly line.
Right.
But why would you name your restaurant McDonald's and not Fox's? It's a quaint indication that the brothers didn't really get that it was a different moment in time in our society. We weren't all about brands. We weren't about, you know, eating in the same place in one town that we ate in another. The world wasn't wired that way. Today, people look for familiar brands when they come into a new town because they want to know it's, you know, I'm going to have my Chipotle burrito that I had back home. Some people do. But that wasn't how the world worked back then. And the brothers didn't understand it. But that guy, Neil Fox, their first franchisee, sure did. He wanted to replicate what the brothers had in San Bernardino because he saw that people loved it. And, you know, maybe that was a risk. Maybe if he had called his place Fox's and just had used the same formula that the brothers had, he would have been just as successful. But we'll never know.
Yeah, and we never know what we might be eating out of a place called Fox's either.
True. Excellent.
Yeah. Yes. Well, you think about it, you have Crocs and Foxes, and you put those two together, it could be really interesting.
You're reminding me why I like to eat at home.
Okay. Well, it's a good thing we're not trying to promote the restaurant today.
Yes.
I don't think I am helping at all.
Exactly. Right. That's another funny thing. The funny thing about McDonald's today versus McDonald's back when it started in San Bernardino is that the food was all locally sourced. All of the food came from local suppliers because back then nobody could haul in food on a refrigerated truck the way it happens today.
Right.
So when you bought a franchise from McDonald's, you weren't buying the food. You were buying the blueprint for starting a McDonald's in your hometown of choice. And it had very specific rules about how you would source the buns from a local baker and source the potatoes and, you know, everything you needed to get up and running. You had to wrangle the food necessary, and it was very simple. In the early days, McDonald's had 9 items on the menu. It wasn't like you went there and there were 10 different variations of a Big Mac or breakfast or any of that. It was just a very simple menu. You know, it was a hamburger. It was a cheeseburger. It was a shake. It was a Coke.
Right.
You know, a cup of coffee. It wasn't like this exhaustive menu that we've become so accustomed to at most any place we go to. So it was a simpler format. But even Ray found out when he opened his first McDonald's in Illinois, back home, as a proof of concept for people who were interested in getting into the business in the Midwest, he found that he couldn't replicate the brothers' formula for making French fried potatoes. And he called Dick and Mac and he said, "What am I doing wrong?" And they realized they were air drying the potatoes in a cage behind the restaurant in San Bernardino.
Oh.
But in Illinois, when you're air drying potatoes in a cage behind your restaurant, the air is completely different.
Yes.
So it's like when you hear people say that bagels are better when you buy them in New York because they're made with New York water. There's environmental factors. So that's why over time, McDonald's developed this standardized, not just formula for making food, but a standardized food. And that's another part of the story that I find so interesting, because we just don't think about food that much. You know, we're hungry, we want to eat.
Yes.
And some of us think about where it comes from, but we don't necessarily think about how it got to where we're buying it. And learning that has been a pleasure.
Yeah, I think some of us don't want to know where some of these things come from, too. It's
like, there's definitely that, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to be able to eat it.
We
go. Now, let's move on a little bit to Joan here, because she plays the most important role in this book. What was Ray's life like before he met Joan? And then we'll get closer to it.
Well, Ray was sort of a wild person with ideas. He was always on the go. He loved to work. He was a workaholic before we called it that. And he basically divorced his wife in the hopes that Joan would marry him.
Wow.
And then instantly married another woman when Joan refused to marry him because he said he couldn't be a bachelor. So he was just sort of a typical man of those days, businessman, a successful businessman. He drank, he lived hard, and Joan was very much like him from a different perspective. And they met and fell pretty much quickly in love, and it took them a long time before they finally married. But I wouldn't say that Ray's life was terribly different after he met Joan. He was his own person till the very end, till he died. So he was a larger-than-life personality.
You say he was a typical man of those times. What that brought to mind for me was John Wayne-type movies where they belly up to the bar and they're loud and braggadocious and all these things. Is that a bit like him?
Yes. He was definitely the kind of guy at the bar who would tell stories and have a swagger, get into trouble. He famously lost part of his finger, smashed in a car door, probably because he was drinking. Yeah, and he liked being out with the guys.
Okay.
It's sort of a stereotypical Mad Men era, if you've seen that.
Yeah.
A businessman of that day, boorish. Definitely it was an old boys club kind of mentality, even though ironically or interestingly, one of his chief associates from the very beginning was his long-term secretary who gave him the $100 to incorporate McDonald's in the first place. And she wound up becoming enormously rich as a result of that. So, yeah, he was a larger-than-life character, and so was Joan, for sure.
Okay, well, they had met years before they married. Why was Joan hesitant to marry Ray?
Well, she was married to somebody else.
Oh, well, that would do it.
That would do it.
Yeah.
They were both married to other people. She was much younger. She had a younger child. Ray's only daughter by his first marriage was grown at that point. It was complicated. It was a complicated situation, and I don't think we'll ever really know exactly why she postponed marrying him. Some people say, you know, when she first met Ray, he was not enormously wealthy. By the time she married him, he was enormously wealthy. So some people draw a dotted line there. You know, life is all about timing, right? And they met, and Joan's first husband got into the McDonald's business. He was hired as a manager of a McDonald's and ultimately became a franchisee. And their lives were indelibly linked to the formation of McDonald's. And yeah, it was just a timing thing.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Because she finally did look and see that, okay, this is somebody I am interested in, and now is the time. Wow. Okay, I'm kind of blown away because there's a lot of things going on with these two.
Yes.
And like all couples, they had their ups and downs.
You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Find many KVC Arts shows via podcast through iTunes, NPR One, Spotify, and Google Play. And most past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. Later in the program, we'll hear about Pierre Bourne, a rap and hip-hop producer. Returning now, though, to Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Lisa Napoli about her book, Ray and Joan, the man who made the McDonald's fortune and the woman who gave it all away.
What was Joan's life like with Ray?
Well, Joan, very quickly, once she realized him, realized that she didn't want to be what we would today call a trophy wife.
Okay.
And, you know, that was sort of what was expected of her. She was much younger. She was the wife. She had been helping her first husband with his McDonald's and was a piano teacher, a piano player. And now all of a sudden she was expected to just go to the spa and sit on committees. And she didn't want that at all. So she very quickly realized what she did want to do was start helping people. And she also realized very quickly just to the extent of which Ray's drinking was an impact on their lives together. But since she couldn't seem to get Ray involved in rehab or stopping his drinking, she decided that she would become an expert in alcohol addiction. And all, you know, from a 360 viewpoint, this is before people routinely talked about such things. And this is, I think, a really important and interesting part of this story, that in the 1970s, before we recognized addiction as widely as we do now, mm-hmm. Joan convened people, social workers and addiction experts, for a big meeting and started something that was groundbreaking called Operation Cork. Which Cork being Croc spelled backwards. And what she did was take a slice of Ray's fortune from, you know, when McDonald's had gone public in 1965, Ray had become enormously wealthy. She took a slice of his fortune that was earmarked for the Croc Foundation and turned it into a sub-foundation that was focused on teaching people about the perils of drinking. And I just love that part of the story. It hadn't been told widely before I wrote this book, and it right. took a lot of digging and acknowledgement of people, because people didn't, you know, nobody wants to come out and say that they're addicted now, but we have much more cultural acceptance of it. But then it was culturally completely taboo that somebody who was enormously successful could have a drinking issue. So what I love about the story is that Joan took her relationship, her perch as this wife of a very wealthy man, and turned it into work that helped so many other people. She made films. She commissioned books. The films aired on network television. She basically used the McDonald's machine of publicity and advertising and directed it toward creating media about the perils of overconsumption of alcohol. And that's an incredibly formidable accomplishment for somebody who basically just barely got out of high school.
Wow.
She was a force of nature, for sure.
Sounds like it.
Now,
for just one moment, Lisa, I'd like to go to the side here a little bit and ask you, would you mind taking a few moments to share with our audience where they can find out more about your book? And will you talk also a little bit about your podcast on aging?
I'd be happy to. So my book is available anywhere you can buy a book. If they don't have it in the store, you can order it. It's online. It's digitally available, and I've also read the book. So if you want me to read you the book while you drive somewhere, it's
right.
me reading it. And rayandjoan.com is where you can find out more about Ray and Joan, okay. and also some myths about the movie The Founder and debunking the myths or the inaccuracies in that film. People ask me that a lot. And then parallel to that, I love speaking about Ray and Joan and their work that she did in her lifetime, but I also produce this podcast on aging gracefully called gracefullyradio.com. And I interview people about subjects having to do with everything having to do with aging, which okay. we're all doing.
Yeah.
Whether we're in our 20s or in our 50s. So that's a fascinating part So basically, gracefully is my way of dealing with ageism in society and ageism that I'm experiencing in the workplace. And I'd love to hear from anybody who's interested in the subjects of elder caregiving or just dealing with families who are far away. I've dealt with all of that in the last couple of years myself, and I just started it as a way to sort of build a community and a dialogue about the issues surrounding aging.
That is really cool. That's something we don't talk about a lot either. We talk about how to care for someone once they've gotten there and what's happening to them while they're there. But yeah, I like that.
Yeah, good.
Thank you.
I hope other people do too. Let's hope so.
Yeah, I think there, well, I'm sure there's a lot more caring about it today than when we were growing up.
Exactly.
Now back to Joan, because as we return to speaking about your book, Ray and Joan, how did Joan influence the McDonald's chain, if she did at all?
Well, she was part of the McDonald's chain from an early age. When she met Ray, her husband, Raleigh, got hired by her boss, who was opening a McDonald's franchise. And so she watched one of the earliest franchises built. And then her husband, Raleigh, got the right to build his own restaurant in Rapid City, South Dakota, the first restaurant in South Dakota, McDonald's restaurant. And so she didn't influence the corporation, but she definitely watched the company in its early stages as it was built franchise by franchise. She went out of her way not to be involved with the corporation once she did marry Ray. She wasn't interested. She called them chauvinists.
They were, for sure.
Yeah. And when he died, when Ray died in 1984, she did not exercise the authority that she had as the largest individual shareholder in McDonald's, which she could have in being involved with McDonald's. So, you know, she had an interesting relationship with the company. She saw it grow from the earliest days.
Now, Joan gave away a great deal to causes that helped people every day, things that people turned their eyes away from, you know, and did not think that they should help with. Maybe, you know, that's like the AIDS epidemic, where people just thought, hey, well, that's on them. They should deal with it. She saw compassion and not only gave there, but gave to so many places, National Public Radio included. Why did she do this?
Well, you know, that is a complex question to answer, and I did write an entire book about it. But the short radio answer is that she did it because she could, and she felt a moral obligation to do it. But what's so interesting, and what I spent years researching and detailing, is the different ways that she did do it, because she was so interested in so many different things. But really, it boils down to compassion. And while some people might have a lot of money and not feel like they needed or were obligated to give it, she was the opposite. She felt like it was part of her obligation as having inherited all this money to do something productive with it.
That's Lisa Napoli in conversation with Emmanuel Rogers. We're hearing about her book, Ray and Joan, The Man Who Made the McDonald's Fortune and the Woman Who Gave It All Away. A little later in the program, we'll hear a brief radio essay about a man who's created identifiable sounds for certain rap and hip-hop artists, Pierre Bourne. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, also at kvcrnews.org.
Now, on your website, and you mentioned this a little earlier, you include a fact-check section because of the movie The Founders that did come out recently. Now, what were some of the things that the makers of the movies, The Founders, took that were not quite accurate and that you have cleared up for us?
Well, the movie The Founder is about the brothers and Ray, and it makes it sound as if the brothers really did Ray out of their due. And the truth is much more complicated than that. As I explained, they asked for a sum of money to walk away from the business that they'd started, and Ray and his team came up with that money, and fair and square, they bought him out. They'd been receiving a royalty all along, and they gave up the right to the future profits of McDonald's when they sold the business to Ray and his chief associate, Harry Sonnenborn. There's another big inaccuracy the movie has to do with Joan, which suggests that Joan's husband built a restaurant. It's much easier if people look at my website, but the biggest issue is that Ray did the brothers in. The brothers were industrious. Some people listening to this may have even known them. They were industrious, hardworking people who had this vision, and they collided with Ray. They had a business alliance with Ray. Ray and his team took that business way further than they ever imagined or had wanted it to go. Ray came to them and said, I want to buy you out. They said, okay. And they bought him out. And the brothers went off and were perfectly comfortable for the rest of their lives. I think that what happens is that people can't understand, with the benefit of history,
right,
why anybody would walk away from McDonald's. But that is like saying, I bought your house for $25,000 and now it's worth 2 minutes. You screwed me. Well, you didn't. It's reductive. It's very Hollywood. And I think the movie had to Hollywood up the story because the reality of it was not quite so controversial or cinematic. It's a certainly really interesting story, but to me the way more interesting story is the romance between Ray and Joan, which right, wasn't really accurately depicted. Ray had another wife before he married Joan. There's a lot of different things, but at rayandjoan.com you can see all what it wasn't right in the film. People love the film, which is great.
Yes.
So I don't want to sound like I'm angry about the film. The film is great.
Right.
But it's not historically accurate. And the biggest inaccuracy is that the brothers are depicted like they're hapless idiots. And Ray looks like he screwed the brothers, and he didn't. It's just not true.
Right.
So I don't want to sound like I'm wagging my finger at it. It's just, it drives me crazy as a historian that people have this mythology. There are a lot of reasons not to like Ray Kroc. He was not a nice, easygoing person.
Right.
And he was very not nice to his wives. If you read my book, you'll see that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the depiction of the business is a little reductive.
And you know, that's pretty amazing because now you say as a historian, I think if anyone were to look back and think 1960, $2.7 million, I don't know how much that's worth today, but that was a great deal of money.
It was a great deal of money for two men who were making excellent money already. And that's not to say, you know, if you're rich, it doesn't mean I should not give you what you were due just because you already had the money. But yeah, like I say, I think it's much more cinematic to say that the brothers, if they had continued to get the royalty that they were getting, the 0.5%, that they'd have X amount of money today. But never once did I, in any of the things I read about Dick McDonald or the interviews I saw, the only time that Dick McDonald got mad was in 1984. And by then, his brother Mac was deceased. Mm-hmm. And Ray Kroc died. And the McDonald Corporation did a whole series of ads saying how Ray was the founder of McDonald's.
Ah.
That's when Dick McDonald got angry. And company went and did some damage control PR as a result of Dick kind of rattling his anger toward the company. But that was the only time he got really angry. But it's a much better story to say, oh, those brothers got screwed. But it's just not true.
Yeah, without the drama, there'd be no Total Drama Island. That old reference.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, just, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
No, Lisa, Joan is just so amazing to me. And I don't want to ask a pointed question, so what I'm going to do is ask you, what were some of the most striking things that you came to appreciate first about Ray and then about Joan?
Again, I wrote a whole book about it.
Yeah.
I just love the idea that a polarizing force like McDonald's, a lot of people hate McDonald's, mm-hmm, gave rise to one of the greatest fortunes of the 20th century, and that a woman who's underrecognized gave it away in so many inventive ways. A lot of people hear philanthropist and they think of some wealthy person sitting on a perch somewhere,
right,
who's dispensing money. And Joan wasn't like that. You know, she'd fly in and try to right a wrong. She'd read an item in the newspaper and call up and give somebody the money they needed to fix something that she read about in the morning's paper when she was having her coffee. She did what I think I would do, I hope I would do, if
right,
I had that kind of money, which is react and create and do amazing things to help other people. It's a remarkable story. Ray is celebrated and studied in business schools around the world as a celebrated businessman, when in fact the real celebrated businessman should be,
right,
his chief money officer, Harry Sonnenborn, who figured out the way to borrow the money, to move money around, and the formula that made McDonald's successful, which was real estate and not the food that McDonald's sold. So I think as I've written this book and researched this book and talk about it now, I just hope that, knowing that a lot of people don't like to read, I hope that people will take a closer look at this force in American and international society and see that there's much more to it. The world isn't as black and white as we think it is. And as I say, I'm not an apologist for McDonald's. I have nothing to do with McDonald's. I'm an independent researcher. But what I've learned as I've gotten older is that a lot of things are not as they seem. And I've become more intrigued by history and how what's happened in the past has got us to where we are today.
Right.
And I think it's really important to look at all of those elements, you know, whether it's the building across the street that you've been staring at for 20 years and know nothing about,
right,
or a person or an institution. And that's the case with this. You know, I fell in love with learning about these two people who I had nothing to do with, never will meet because they're long gone. I'm just so intrigued by the impact that they had.
It is a very interesting book. And I don't know, for those who watched the movie, The Founder, and then you look at the book, I think the book has actually more drama in it because it's real. They could have actually made a movie about Ray drinking Canadian Club as one of those asides they used, when that really wasn't the case, you know, just for drama.
Well, he also didn't drink Canadian Club.
Yeah.
It's even worse than Canadian Club, but they must have had a product placement for the movie or something because, oh, what is it? Early Times. Early Times whiskey is what Ray really drank. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I always say I wish that somebody had made a movie about Joan and looked at 1984 in Joan's life, the year Ray died, the year someone went into a San Ysidro McDonald's and murdered.
Oh, wow.
You know, yeah. Largest mass murder of history at the time. And she swooped in, started a victims fund, started going down to San Ysidro, a very poor community, and meeting with people who were affected by the gunmen who lost families. She became involved with the gunman's widow. And then later that year, she helped take the San Diego Padres to the World Series. Her husband had bought the team in 1974, and she inherited it when he died. To me, 1984 is a movie in itself, the year in Joan's life when Ray passes away. So, yeah, it's all how you slice it, I guess. It's a very interesting story.
Well, are they waiting for you to get the manuscript together for 1984, or what's going on there?
Oh, no. If we were to talk about how movies get made, we would be here for another 4 hours, and I'm not expert in that. I can just tell you that the movie business is even wackier than the publishing business, and it doesn't work that way. And I wish, otherwise I'd sit down and write it, although I don't see that many movies, so I really couldn't write a movie, but that's a whole other conversation.
Well, you know enough people to get some help there, I am sure. So.
Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way, but that's very nice of you to say.
Okay. Well, it looks like our time is coming to an end, Lisa. We spent some good quality time here talking about Ray and Joan, and I do appreciate it.
Thank you for your interest.
Oh, you're more than welcome. I enjoy this. I enjoy learning, just as I said before, and it's something to learn about. Especially, I get to see that first McDonald's around the corner from me out here. It's not kept up very well, but it is still there. People can still go by and look at that first McDonald's here in San Bernardino, California.
Well, and it's a museum now.
Yeah.
Not run by the company, but yeah, it's worth checking out. It's a fascinating place.
Yes, it is.
Right,
and it
there.
Might actually still have some of the original Good Burgers there.
You can't go there to eat. Can go there to
right.
learn. Different sort of nourishment.
Yeah, and I'm sure they can send out for
yes,
you.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
We've talked about a lot of things. Is there anything that I may have neglected to speak on that you would like the audience to know about Ray and Joan?
No, I think you've been terrific, and I really appreciate your time.
You are more than welcome. I really enjoyed speaking with you, and I'll be waiting for your book on CNN to come out.
Thank you, and I'm counting on you to help me get the word out about it.
All right. I am here and glad to do it.
Excellent. Excellent. Thanks again.
You're welcome. Thank you, Lisa.
That was Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Lisa Napoli about her book, Ray and Joan, The Man Who Made the McDonald's Fortune and the Woman Who Gave It All Away. You can find the book at most booksellers, in stores, as well as online. Also, more at rayandjoan.com. I'm David Fleming. Before we close this edition of KVC Arts, we welcome back Miles Johnson, checking out a bit of rap and hip-hop. Not a particular artist, though, one of the producers behind a sound that some may recognize immediately.
Yo, Pierre.
You want to come out here?
Pierre Bourne. In the late 90s, Jamie Foxx, actor, singer, and comedian extraordinaire, starred in his own sitcom called The Jamie Foxx Show. In the opening scene of the show's fourth episode, Jamie is waiting tables in his hotel's restaurant. After a patron complains about his French toast, Jamie says that they have a chef directly from France and yells out, "Yo, Pierre, you want to come out here?" Fast forward 2 decades later, and those lines have become the tag of producer Pierre Bourne, known for being the man behind Playboy Cardi's hit Magnolia. Bourne's tag is a phrase, 8 words, that stand out because of their humor, creativity, and cultural significance. The cleverness of the tag runs contrary to other well-known producers like Sunny Digital or Zaytoven, whose tags are merely warped and manufactured retellings of their names. These tags, while producing the same result of notifying listeners as to who produced the song, lack a sense of originality and effort. They draw to the imagination Zaytoven in the studio thinking he needs a tag, so he hurriedly records a friend saying his name, edits it, then injects it into one of his songs. Bourne's tag uses a Jamie Foxx sample that is such a deep cut, it's really a gem that a producer named Pierre was aware of the clip and thought to use it as his tag. Furthermore, Bourne doesn't let the sample go to waste, as he emulates the Jamie Foxx scene and brings it to life. In the show, Foxx calls out for a fictitious cook to come out and deal with the food. "Yo, Pierre, you want to come out here?" While in his songs, the call is for Bourne to come out and give us his instrumental. It's like a rapper saying, "Yo, DJ, lay down a beat." A call to the man behind the music that it's time to step up and flex. In Magnolia, Bourne doesn't disappoint, coming through with a boisterous, distorted, hi-fi sound that's eager to be rapped on. There is no apprehension on Magnolia. Bourne answers the call well.
"Yo, Pierre, you wanna come out here?"
That was Miles Johnson to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks to Miles, as well as to Emmanuel Rogers and his conversation with author Lisa Napoli. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, and Shireen Awad. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. Find many KVC Arts shows via podcast through iTunes, NPR One, Spotify, and Google Play, and most past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support any time of the year at kvcrnews.org.